Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. At a time when so many people in the world seem to be asking hard questions about America's empire and about Iraq, along comes a new book that describes America's exceptional character and considers how a nation of immigrants who were determined to leave their old homes behind ended up as a global power bent on going back out into the world to clean it up, to restore it to order. These are the words and the ideas of Bill Emmett. For 10 years, he's been executive editor at The Economist magazine, some 40 years after President Kennedy talked of a country willing to bear any burden, pay any price. Emmett is asking if America will remain the world's peacekeeper and dominant power. Beyond that, he's asking if the American style of capitalism, the capitalism that led this country to its current preeminence, will also endure. Connection listeners, what are your thoughts? What will America's place be in this century? Will it maintain its economic and geopolitical power? And to what ends will it use the power that it has? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Bill Emmett's put these ideas together in a new book. The title is 2021 Vision, 20th Century Lessons for the 21st Century. Bill's with me in the studio. Welcome to The Connection.
Glad to be here.
You begin by saying that as journalists, we actually don't do a very good job of looking ahead with the sort of context that we ought to, that we're focused too much on what, would you say?
I think we're always focused on the very short term. It's understandable. After all, the news cycle is so short, and I think our perspectives of as human beings tend to be short. It's striking when you read a historian writing about, I don't know, the 19th century or even the 18th century. They talk about trends going on over 35 years, almost as if it's 1 week. And I think that tells you the difference between them and us journalists. We tend to think that the long term is the amount of time between today's column and the next column, and fail to look at the context, the perspective in which certain events need to be seen.
So you say it's important that we look back, review the 20th century to try and learn what's likely to happen in the 21st. But people tell us that all the time. Learn your history. What is it specifically that you want us to focus on in the 20th century that you think has a lesson for us in the years ahead?
Well, I think two things. One is that we've looked at the 20th century often as a century in which communism was tried and failed. And that's true, but my belief is that we're looking at the wrong thing there. We should ask ourselves why communism got there in the first place and realize that what the century showed us was that capitalism has some failings, which led people to try communism. The second thing, which is more strong for today, is that the first half of the 20th century shows how dangerous it is when you don't have a dominant power. My own country, Britain, had been the imperial dominating power of the 19th century. Its power was weakening in the first decade of the 20th century. And the result of that was conflict between it and Germany and Japan and Russia and a lot of other rising powers around the world. And we should look into today's world to see what's the guarantees that we have against such conflict, fear and ambition driving our world to another disastrous time.
Should we just accept for the purposes of the conversation that since 1945, America has assumed that place, that America has taken over from the Brits as the preeminent power, as the world's empire?
We should take that as a given. We shouldn't take it as a given for the future, however. I think that has been what has happened since 1945. But two things threaten it always. One is the willingness of Americans to take on those obligations. The other is the willingness of the rest of the world to accept that leadership from America. The willingness of Americans obviously varies with the economy. It varies with the price in terms of lives lost and burdens borne that sort of international role produces. The willingness of other people, obviously, we are seeing tested right now with the opposition around the world, often to military action against Iraq. A lot of criticism of America, a lot of people trying to describe America as the bully rather than Saddam Hussein as the bully. We see the nascent criticism of the imperial power, which I think America always needs to try to fight against.
And a lot of the people in this country are hearing that criticism now and wondering whether or not this country is headed in the right direction. Let me turn to the editorial side of the editor here and ask you for your opinion. I mean, if we are speaking about this country as having taken a certain stance, a certain or I guess having assumed that position by virtue of its economic and its military power, should people be spending as much time as they are looking at the debate that's underway at the UN, all the voices of dissent from Europe?
I think you have to look at all those voices of dissent and look at the debate underway for a simple reason. That is that while I think America is on the right course in being engaged and active internationally, what it must realize is that powerful as it isn't actually powerful enough to act alone, nor powerful enough to sort out all the world's problems, just because the world's problems are too large and complex. And thank goodness, America has so many scruples about how it sorts them out. That means it needs allies, and so it does need to worry about the voices of dissent.
I'm asking the question in part because I wonder if you listen to both sides of the argument and feel that there aren't enough cheerleaders for the American perspective here at times. You'll look at this from that odd position in an island between Europe and the United States, for example.
I certainly think that in my country, what surprised me since September the 11th, but also particularly in the last 9 months during the debate about Iraq, how few cheerleaders there have been for the United States. I've suddenly had to get used to the idea that I am exceptional as a cheerleader for the United States and that my magazine, The Economist, is exceptional as a cheerleader for the United States, whereas previously I would have just assumed that this was the natural position. At least among the commentators, in Britain even, there's a remarkable unwillingness to give the United States the benefit of the doubt and a remarkable willingness to give Saddam Hussein or whichever other dictator we're talking about the benefit of their doubt. And I struggle to understand it sometimes.
I mean, the other side of the argument, and we hear it often on this program, is that the United States' record of standing up for peace and security of the world is easily challenged. The United States was late into Bosnia, if you want to take that perspective. The United States never went to Rwanda to help the people there. The United States, prior to September 11th, wasn't in any way inclined towards being engaged with the rest of the world.
I think it's certainly true that the United States can be criticized both for being too inactive and for being too active. It's perhaps the burden of being the superpower, but also something of a reluctant superpower. I think during the 1990s in particular, although the Clinton administration got involved a bit in all sorts of different problems around the world, including with military intervention, it was quite reluctant to, because public opinion was quite reluctant to get involved, particularly after Somalia and the terrible things that happened to some U.S. forces in Somalia. That produced a sort of short attention span and a sort of desire to get involved when necessary but try to make sure that it wasn't necessary. I think that since September 11th, the increased willingness of America to get involved has been a good thing and will prove to have been a good thing when historians look back at it in 5 or 10 years' time or 25 years' time. Of course, many things can go wrong, but I actually think that the basic thrust of the new engagement, as I would see it, particularly in the Middle East, is likely to bring about more benefits than costs.
You describe yourself as a paranoid optimist. A paranoid optimist, to me, is like a small child who knows that she can swim across a swimming pool, but is afraid to because there could be sharks in the water. Now, what are you telling us? That we need to be extremely careful when judging the activity of a superpower, but that the superpower needs to have the benefit of the doubt?
It's a nice analogy, your shark analogy. I think that what I'm saying is that the basic foundations of the future are strong, partly because the superpower is there, willing and able to keep the peace, also because I think the spread of capitalism around the world over the last 20 years, particularly into new countries like China, countries that previously were shut off like India, the Eastern European countries and so on, is profound. Globalization is real, and that means that there's a real good prospect for growth in the future. The long term, I think, will be very positive, but positive long terms consist of a lot of to's and fro's, of ups and downs in the short term, and I think that there are risks in that to and fro and up and down in the short term that we have to be aware of. You have to be paranoid about the terrorists that could come along with biological or nuclear weapons, paranoid about an Iraq war that could widen and take in other countries, paranoid about what could happen in North Korea, because being paranoid makes you more able to deal with those risks. And I think a superpower that was complacent about its abilities, and particularly complacent about its abilities to overcome every problem in the world, would probably be one that would cause problems and maybe be accident prone. I think be aware of the risks is my lesson.
I want to quote a line from the book which made me pause, made me think a bit, and I'll get you to talk a bit about it. You write, "The United States is the first preeminent power in history, whose ideas, if they triumph, would bring about the loss of its own dominance." It's never happened before, has it?
Not that I'm aware of. You could argue that Britain, by spreading the rule of law and a relatively modern economy, did help to facilitate growth of some other countries that took over from it in the end, certainly perhaps by colonizing the United States and then losing the War of Independence. That was perhaps the best thing we ever did for the world. You could argue that, but I don't think it's as strong as with the United States, where if China, if India, if Nigeria, if Brazil really followed open trade, free market capitalism of something like an American style, it doesn't need to be a clone of America, but something in that direction, democracy that provided the accountability, then all the experience of history says that they will grow stronger and that power will become more shared around the world. Indeed, I think that's the likeliest outcome in the 21st century, that we begin it with American dominance. By the end of it, I hope we will have other countries that are just as strong as America. That may be difficult for Americans to deal with, but I think the ideals of America give me some hope that Americans will consider that that's a good thing.
All right, Connection listeners, there's a question, there's a challenge for you. Globalization, capitalism, and the ideas that America is exporting to the developing world are the same ideas that would, in fact, take away America's preeminence as the world power. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio, Bill Emmett, editor of The Economist magazine. He's held that position for the past 10 years. He's author of a new book called 2021 Vision, 20th Century Lessons for the 21st Century. And this notion that we were just getting into, the idea of America actually sowing the seeds of its own diminish, what's the word I'm looking for? You're better with words than I. Diminution? I'm not sure. It's all keyed to globalization. And you actually say in the book, we, meaning those in support of globalization, really need to win that argument. for globalization? Are you concerned that perhaps it's not being won?
Yes, I am concerned about that. I think it's one of the big battles that an editor like me at a publication like The Economist needs to fight week in, week out, month after month, because I think people see globalization too much as change that shakes up the existing fabric of countries in a bad way rather than in a good way. You know, capitalism and economic growth don't come without change. They are change. They are about change. And I think one should look back at what happened to Europe in the 50 years since 1945. In 1945, Europe was devastated. Many of its countries were poor. Italy was basically a rural country. France even was pretty poor. Scandinavia was terribly poor. Free trade, peace, under the American umbrella of policemanship, if you like, and the growth of the European Union, which spread markets, a single market across the continent of Europe, enabled Europe to close the gap with the United States. Exactly the phenomenon that I'm hoping for the future, vis-a-vis China, India, Brazil, many of the big countries of the developing world. That's what happened with Europe in the 50 years after 1945. We've got a case when it worked. Europe and the U.S. are now very equal in economic terms. They're not equal in political terms, but they're equal in economic terms.
There's a danger, though, that you flag, and that is that it's important to have governments separate from the corporations that are in the countries, that it is important to have a certain amount of regulation, but not too much regulation, and that one of the black holes you can fall into is having corporations so wound up with their governments that they end up making the rules or participating in the creation of those rules. And you write about Enron as an example of that. And I'm wondering whether or not the people who disagree with the idea that globalization is the salvation might not be able to make a good case to you by saying, you know what, Bill Emmett, it's the corporations making the rules as much as the politicians now, and their interests don't have the interests of the people at heart the way that you're saying, you know, it would if it was working properly.
Well, I think that is a danger. And I, by the way, think that the country which epitomizes that danger most is the United States of America, where the democracy is and the political system is so open and where public campaign finance is treated as a free speech issue. Famously, the effort by corporations to capture the democratic process is probably more advanced than almost anywhere else. I would say that in most developing countries, the unglobalized state of things is one where governments and companies, or at least economic entities, tend to be very close together. You get you get monopolies, you get corruption, you get a few elitists gaining all the assets and everyone else being poor. Typically, the process of globalization opens up the system to new competition, to new entrepreneurs, in a way that actually broadens the economy and broadens political power, disperses it. That's what's happening in China, for example. A great threat to the Communist Party of China is that there's more and more power being dispersed to individuals, to smaller companies, some bigger companies, but a lot of smaller companies, and that's making it harder for them as a government to keep a grip on the country. So I think it depends where you're starting from, how big a problem this is.
1-800-423-8255. We'll take our first call from Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah's on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. This is really fascinating. My question is, you were referring earlier to limits on capitalism, and what frightens me most about capitalism right now is that since it is based on an idea of constant and endless growth, I see ecological limits in terms of using up resources and producing pollution, and I wonder if that's one of the limits that you're referring to. And if it is, I wonder what alternatives you see, what practical alternatives, and how might they be implemented?
Yes, I absolutely see that as one of the issues about capitalism. In my book, I've got a series of chapters on each of the weaknesses of capitalism, one of which is called unclean. In other words, the fact that capitalism tends towards a conflict with the environment. I think it's a job for regulation. I think that the big problems are not so much that in the limits to our growth from the scarcity of resources, because one of the truths of our time is that we keep finding more resources and better ways to use them, but rather the limits that come from pollution and from the effect that capitalism has on our immediate environment, such as through urban sprawl. We need governments to deal with this. We need ways to, through the democratic process, force companies and particularly prices in markets to reflect the value that you and I put on our environment.
Mm-hmm.
I, for example, think that gasoline should cost a lot more in the United States and that taxes should be put on gasoline to try to reduce its use and perhaps also to finance the federal budget deficit. This isn't a particularly popular view in this country, I know, but perhaps because I come from a high-tax country, Britain, where our gas costs a lot.
Sarah, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Ashland, Massachusetts, and Imran's joining us. Hi, Imran.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was wondering if the author could comment on the issue of colonialism. I think what I kind of think about as a 20th century is the end of British colonialism, French colonialism, fall of the Ottoman Empire, and then with the ascendancy of America, kind of America adopting a lot of Europe's headaches. And so the Middle East is a great example. And so looking for a lesson learned, what I wonder about is will America take a lesson from Europe, which is that, you know, colonialism, I mean, I think it's much more subtle now in the sense that it gets orchestrated through financial markets or perhaps, you know, stationing of the military in various countries, trying to put leaders in place like perhaps Hamid Karzai, or if we're looking for someone to replace Saddam Hussein. Those types of things get perceived as a new form of colonialism. And so what lessons could be learned?
I think it's a terrific question. You're right, the 20th century saw the demise of the old form of colonialism. And I think the United States, in its period of power, I don't see it as an imperial power or a colonial power, but there's no doubt that its spread of bases, its spread of obligations overseas mean that it is often going to be blamed for things, and indeed that it's often responsible for things. I think perhaps the prime objective that I would say should be followed in the Middle East during what I see as basically the next 10 years is to arrive at a time when the Middle East no longer blames the United States for its problems and only blames itself for its problems, that the U.S. needs to try to move to a time and a situation when it is on the outside willing to come in and help people if they need it, but not actually pulling the strings and dominating things. I think in Iraq, for example, it's vital to for the U.S. to try to set up a system where it leaves as quickly as possible, maybe after 1 year, 2 years, but not 5 years, as was the case in Japan after the Second World War, for example. I think a quick exit is important because the U.S. mustn't be pulling the strings.
But do you see that a quick exit kind of leads to a repeat of what happened in Afghanistan, which is a power vacuum, and then you kind of create the ripe conditions for a Taliban-like situation, given the fact that things are in such disarray?
That's the dilemma. I think that what's happened in Afghanistan since the war in late 2001 is that there's been enough money and enough continued presence, both of American and foreign troops there, that there isn't a power vacuum, but nevertheless it's not exactly an ideal situation. We're not in a pre-Taliban time. I think it's important that money continues to be provided. I also think it's important to get other countries involved. This is another reason why I think the U.S., for all its dominance, needs partners. Let's have Britain blamed. Let's have Turkey blamed. Let's have Germany blamed. Let's have France blamed as well. In other words, be part of a United Nations force, which is the sort of thing that we've got in the Balkans now. The U.S. is not seen as, if you like, the colonial power in Bosnia and in Kosovo, even though it led both of the military operations there. Why? Because actually the situation there now is not dominated by U.S. troops, nor indeed by U.S. officials. And I think that's an important goal I see for the U.S., which is why multilateralism, working with partners, is so valuable in the U.S.'s interests, because it shares the burden.
But if we go back to your look at the 20th century, from the end of the Second World War until the collapse of the Soviet Union, that 40-some-odd years, the United States behaved as an empire, not unlike former empires, by trying to spread its influence to nations abroad. There was the fight. This is going to be a capitalist country. It's not going to be a communist country. When that ended, do you see that as creating a moment of confusion for the United States in trying to figure out how then it's supposed to behave or act in the world? And I'm wondering if right at this point, the sort of 10-year gap there, right at this point, we're moving perhaps to an answer to that question.
Well, I think you're right that that there was some direct imposition of ideas, I mean, and methods during the Cold War. Since then, it's been more through persuasion and through ideas. But if you look at the whole period, it's been remarkably successful. You know, now, for the first time in history, more than half of the world's population lives in democracies, places with elections, with some sort of democratic control. That is a huge credit to the United States. It's not imposed by the United States, but it's a credit to the ideas exemplified by the United States and encouraged by it. Similarly, capitalism, open capitalism, has spread much more widely over the last 20 years than before. That, too, is an example of the spread, I think, of American influence. That is the outcome that the U.S. needs to push even further, that America's soft power, its ideas, the values it stands for, spread without it actually needing to send in troops to try to enforce them. I think America has enormous power by its own example, by conduct and example, as a former Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, said as a recommendation to Japan, how they should act in the world, by conduct and example. And I think that's the biggest contribution that America has as well.
All right, Imran, thanks for that call. Next to Orleans, Massachusetts, Dana's on the line. Hi, Dana.
Hi, good morning to both of you. I'd like to open by comment is just it's kind of discouraging to me that in the 21st century you have an advocate for imperialism, and he's using the mythology of America, the self-serving mythology of America as the moral example for the world, which is a lie, to make his case, because America has a lot of blood on its hands right from the times the settlers came here right till today. I think Bush's motivations for invading Iraq are highly questionable and open to debate. And
Dana, which would you like us to pick up? That the thesis is flawed because it's not taking into account the American history
The history of how the concept called United States was born and how it formed over the years. And all we're taught is the expansion west as determined, God-fearing people. These people massacred a lot of other people along the way and took their land and destroyed their cultures. And I think today we have the same problem with, I think, that same arrogance is embodied in President Bush today and his motivations for trying to get rid of the so-called axis of evil. This is just another ruse, in my opinion, to yet invade and keep everybody, aligned with the so-called New World Order, to use a phrase of his dad's, I guess.
Dana, let me step in here and let Bill speak for a minute.
Sure. Look, first of all, I don't think I'm an advocate of imperialism. But secondly, I absolutely agree with you that the U.S. is flawed. It is not a perfect example. Indeed, it is highly imperfect. All human examples are highly imperfect, whether because of original sin or just because you cannot escape from your history. We are all flawed. I would say that probably many of those terrible things that happened in the birth of the United States should be blamed on Britain, since they were being done by British settlers, by the way. But in any case, you cannot get away from it, and of course, you cannot pretend, one cannot pretend that America is somehow morally perfect. I just think it's a better example than much of the rest of the world, and therefore particularly the good things about America, about freedom, about democracy, about the restraint on government, are to be exported. As far as Iraq is concerned, I think you and I do disagree on that. It seems to me that Saddam Hussein has had 17 United Nations resolutions so far calling on him to disarm from his chemical, nuclear, and biological weapons. The United Nations confronted him. He basically managed to push them away and to continue with his brutal, genocidal behavior inside his country. I think it's one example in which I'm glad that a country is willing to stand up and say this cannot go on, and that the principles of the United Nations should be enforced and defended. So I feel that Iraq is actually a good case on my side. If we looked at Israel and Palestine, I think that it's a much more mixed picture as to whether or not American influence is for the good or the ill. I think it's a more complicated one, but also it's harder to see where good and evil sits, and I would criticize the Bush administration for oversimplifying and cloaking in too much moral language a conflict that is basically a civil war on which there is evil on both sides and good on both sides.
All right, Dana, thanks for that call. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about the American empire as it exists, as it behaves, and asking really whether or not the political and the economic underpinnings of the American empire are such that it will continue on into the next century. Your thoughts on that at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WB.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. American Empire Connection listeners, if it's in place right now, what will it take to keep it in place? Should it be allowed to stay in place? How should America exercise the power that it has politically and economically? You have the numbers. I have the guest. His name is Bill Emmett. He's editor of The Economist magazine. New book called 2021 Vision, 20th Century Lessons for the 21st Century. A number of you will recall Bill's earlier book. The Sun also sets the limits to Japan's economic power. Let's go back to the lines now to Needham, Massachusetts, and Dennis is with us. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I guess I should have read your guest's earlier book because my question was just that. It will Japan be able to reemerge? You've been talking about emerging leadership nations. Do you think Japan has what it takes to reemerge, especially since China and eventually a unified Korea will be, vying for leadership in that sphere and worldwide? What does he think about Japan's chances of coming back? I think they have a lot to offer the world economically, but clearly they've got a lot of internal problems. So that's my question.
All right. Thanks for that, Dennis.
Thank you.
You lived there for a period of time.
I lived there for a few years in the 1980s during the boom times, as far as Japan was concerned.
The boom times, they are not today.
Absolutely not. They were incredibly arrogant in those days, and now they're incredibly humble, always asking for advice from outsiders. And I think that they do have the potential to reemerge. I think they will reemerge. I'm a sort of short-term pessimist, but a long-term optimist about Japan. They've basically got paralyzed by interest group politics, everyone resisting change, those who have already got economic power and wherewithal blocking change that would release the energies of the economy. And in a way, they're too rich, by which I mean that the people of Japan have put up with the stagnation of the 1990s because it hasn't made them terribly poor. They're still rich enough to tolerate it. I think if Japan could have an economic crisis, which I'm sure will happen sometime in the next 5 years, from that, the energy of Japan will then be released as these blocking interest groups get broken. Then I think Japan's got a terrific amount to give the world. Wonderful education system, wonderfully entrepreneurial, wonderfully capable economically. Actually, I think there's even some political things they can bring to us.
Let's take the example of Japan as it applies to an analysis of American empire, though. If you say that it fell apart as a result of the paralysis brought along by interest group politics, is that same warning something that needs to be heeded in the United States?
Yes, it is. I think it's a warning for all of our democratic societies that that we need to prevent interest groups blocking change. I think the U.S. has had times during the last 20 years when that's been a problem. I think during the 1980s, for example, a lot of the Reagan reforms in the economy and those started by Jimmy Carter before the deregulatory reforms were designed to try to cast out some of the interest group blockages, and the battle goes on. And I think the great thing about the United States economically is that ways have continually been found to try to push aside some of the interest groups, but they are there. They're powerful. They've got money. They've got the wherewithal to try to protect their positions. So it's a constant battle.
In part, though, when you're talking about and writing about the United States, you do keep coming back to the power of the market as pushing past whatever it is the interest groups might do, whatever it is a group of politicians or a region might choose for national policy. That part or large part of the success has been that the market has been allowed to make a lot of those decisions over the past decades.
Yes, I think if you compare the United States with actually any other developed country, what is exceptional about the United States is the tolerance of the American people, of American society, of the devastating changes brought by the market, brought by the waves of creative destruction that capitalism brings. A tolerance, in other words, of inequality, a tolerance of poverty, a tolerance of change, a tolerance of short-term unemployment, as the market dumps one activity and moves on to the next. That really is very different in the United States compared with Europe, and I think is a big reason why the U.S. is so energetic. Also, the willingness of America to be so open to immigration is a big reason why the U.S. continues to grow so fast.
All right, 1-800-423-8255 to New Orleans, Louisiana now, and John's joining us. Hi, John.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question is this. I'm a 30-year-old male, and from my perspective, I have a bunch of friends in my generation who are wealthier than their parents were at this age and maybe don't necessarily appreciate what we have. We've been advertised to all our life, and I'd like to know the concerns you might have when our generation starts making our way more and more into the political system and what advantages we might bring to the table.
All right, John, thanks for that.
That's a very challenging question. I think that the first thing I'd say is that it has been true of many generations over the last 50 years that the next generation has been wealthier than the parents. I think that's only been interrupted really once from the mid-80s to the mid-90s when there was some concern that the next generation was going to be poorer than the parents. So it's been a challenge that has been there and that we can look back at history to see what it brings. I think that what's crucial for us is that your generation is curious and exploratory for change, for the new things, continually looking for new ways to create wealth, but also to then distribute it. I think one of the great things about America is the philanthropy of America, the willingness to pay money to charity, the willingness to redistribute money once it's made. And one of the key questions about a society is, will there be a time come when the wealthy in that society decide, oh, well, I think I'll hang on to my wealth and not share it? So far, that hasn't really happened for any sustained period in the United States. I think what's crucial for the future is that it should not happen, and that the continued circulation of wealth and a sense of obligation within the society, personal obligation, not governmental obligation, should be maintained.
I won't drag you into this country's debate over the proposal by the president to have tax cuts on dividends. I'm sure you're well aware of that. But I'm interested in asking you to follow through the answer that you've given to John, as well as what you were saying before about the tolerance for the inequalities brought about by capitalism. Is it reasonable to say that the country tolerates job loss and factory closures and the sorts of gales of destruction that you describe because the voices belong to those who are powerful and that the poor don't have a voice? I mean, one of the debates that's very current in the country right now is about the growing power of the wealthy, and the wealth that's being gathered all on one side of the ledger in this and the poverty at the other side. You don't look at that and say, maybe that will prove to be a dividing flaw in capitalism as we look ahead.
Well, I think that is the debate that lies behind some of the reaction to Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, a lot of the abuses of corporate power that took place during the new economy period of 98 to 2001. And I think it's healthy that there should be that reaction. I think that as an outsider, what I see in this society is an acceptance of inequality if it seems to be merited inequality and if it seems to involve the use of power but not the abuse of power. I think the idea of social mobility is vital in this society, but also the idea of the rule of law. And that people can't get away with crime. What's crucial in this period, with the reaction to Enron, WorldCom, and so on, is that people are locked up insofar as they committed crimes, and that they are seen to be locked up, just as they were during the savings and loan bust of the 1980s. As a defender of capitalism in my magazine, I think that an obligation is on people like me to attack abuses of capitalism when they occur because they discredit the whole operation. And I think that's vital to defend the toleration of inequality and poverty in this society, too, that the rule of law is enforced.
We were saying prior to the beginning of this hour that the book that you've written, you actually started it before September 11th. You had to delay it a little bit because there were so many things were happening and you were so busy as a journalist. And here you are in this country talking about the book in a very pivotal week with the appearance before the UN Security Council this week of the United States Secretary of State Colin Powell to make the case, to further make the case against Iraq. Do you kind of go back and forth between taking the long view that you write about, but also noting that there are moments that are pivotal?
Oh, I edit a weekly magazine. I have to write about it every week and manage my writers writing about it every week. What we try to do at The Economist is to put things into a longer-term perspective as well. It's hard to do because you can't see the long term stretching in front of you. You have to react to what you know rather than what you might know in the future. But I think it is vital to put things into a perspective, which is why we've taken the position that we do over Iraq, because I think many people react against the Bush administration's position on Iraq because they see it as being something that has just been cooked up since 9/11. I think that's wrong. I think it goes back more than 12 years. It's a long-term problem for which we need a solution. This week's going to be a very interesting week. I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times last week after the State of the Union address in which I said that I thought it was vital that Secretary of State Powell produces some convincing evidence for the Security Council to be able to sway some of the doubters. I am not among the doubters, but I think that it's important that the U.S. goes into Iraq with its case well made, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to say.
And if we judge how well the case is made, do we make that judgment? Do you make that judgment based on anybody's mind being changed as of Wednesday, the Chinese perhaps withdrawing from the rhetoric that says, no, we'll veto anything, or the French or the Germans or the Russians? I mean, how are you going to measure that?
I think I will measure it partly by the French and the Russians. As a Brit, it causes me some discomfort to think that I depend on the French changing their minds. We are traditionally not very keen on France and its views, but I think that that will be an important test. My guess is that the French are willing to change their mind and that it won't take much evidence to flip them over, because I think that basically they agree with the U.S. on Iraq, but they agree with the end, but not necessarily feeling comfortable about the means, and they want the case made more convincingly to their own public, because their own public is very nervous of it. And perhaps the paradox of it is that I think that the French are more nervous of future terrorism even than the Americans are, the Americans having been the most recent victim of devastating terrorism. The French are actually even more nervous of it now, and I think that's one of the reasons why they're so reluctant. They've got a very big Muslim population. They are afraid that within that population there are cells of al-Qaeda terrorists and that those cells might be activated. So they're in a way more nervous about the war on terror even than the United States is.
And as go the French, so go the Germans? And in terms of where they choose to put their support?
I think the Germans will vote against. I think the Germans have taken what to me is an incomprehensible position of being against the war on any circumstances, and the only consistent thing for them to do is to vote against. So I doubt if they'll change their minds, but I think the French probably will.
So there it is, Connection listeners, a little short-term, a little long-term. Bill Emmett, thanks so much for being with us.
Great pleasure. It was fun.
And for Connection listeners in the Boston area, Bill Emmett will be speaking on The Promise and Problems of American Power at the Kennedy School of Government. That's tonight at 6 p.m. If you need to refer to our website for place and time, you can do that. We are at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugertz. Our interns are Danielle Codd and Kevin Sangudi. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR.